Good evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. Tonight, I have a really fun author with me who's written 6 best-selling novels. He's also traveled by air as a pilot to at least 40 countries around the world. I can't wait for you to hear Philip Donnelly. Hang on one second, and we'll be right back. Part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, my guest is author Philip Donnelly. I have to tell you, he's a very interesting man. Just let me tell you a little bit about his bio. He claims that there were 2 distinct events in his life that occurred in his teens that absolutely shaped everything he would do in his future. At the age of 17, he earned his pilot's license, which is a real big deal. And at 18, he was published in a national aviation magazine. So those 2 passions became his careers, both as a professional pilot and a novelist. I can't wait for you to hear more about it, and I'm going to learn more about it. But in the meantime, please let me introduce Philip Donnelly. Phil, welcome to Authors on the Air. Thank you so much for calling me from the road and being on the show.
Pam, it's good to be here. I'm happy to be here. I've been excited about it since we set this up.
I'm thrilled. It's about time, too. I've been reading your books for years now, and when your publicist got in touch with me, he said, Pam, when are you going to put Phil on? And I said, well, I didn't know he wanted to come on the show. Of course I'll put him on. I read all his books. You send them to me all the time. So there you go. It was meant to be. It was kismet. So I love your bio, brief as it is, on your quite lovely website, by the way. And for those of you listening, it's Philip with 1L, Donnelly, donnelly.com. I urge you to go and look at this webpage. It's beautiful. It speaks to your love of flying and also to your books. Tell me about why you decided you had to get a pilot's license.
Well, I don't know that I ever had a choice in the matter. I was a little boy growing up in Wichita, Kansas, which is where it's the home of Cessna and Beechcraft and Learjet, and airplanes were just part of the fabric of the town. And my grandfather lived on the family farm about 100 miles west of Wichita. He was a private pilot, and he had a little Cessna. So I think if the history is told to me correctly, I was about 4 years old when he first took me up, and I was scared to death and couldn't wait to do it again. So
how about that? It's kind of like writing books, right?
Well, you can't. You know, it's like if it's in your blood, you can't walk away. There's no way to do that.
So you kind of had jet fuel in your blood from a very young age.
Yeah, you know, and I grew up in a place that was pretty, where there was a lot of opportunities, which I don't know that the time, place, circumstance exists today that existed back when I was a teenager. So I actually worked on that family farm it was the summer between junior and senior year in high school, got enough of a pile of money to start taking flying lessons. You have to be 16 to solo. You have to be 17 to actually get your license. So that was just in the cards. That was part of being 17, was getting my pilot's license. So I did.
But what about the writing about all of it? Now, shortly after you got your pilot's license, you wrote an article for a national aviation magazine. How did you decide to do that, and what was it about?
Well, I was in high school. I was looking around, and I'd always been a reader, and I grew up reading, and I had been kind of curious about writing. I didn't know a lot about it, but I heard a rumor that if you take journalism class, there's a lot more girls in that class than boys in high school. So I thought,
oh, I heard just the opposite. What a lie we were told. It was an even number. Let's be serious.
It was great. There was like three guys and the rest were girls, and I spent two just fun filled years on the school newspaper and just doing all kinds of things like that, and so the article came about. It wasn't anything I'd set out to do. It was English 101 in college, and I had been given an assignment to write a magazine article. And I did. I wrote about an airplane incident. And the instructor, gave me a B, of all things. I was pretty incensed. And so just because 18-year-olds are just built that way, I submitted it to a magazine. And about 6 weeks later, a check showed up in the mail, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I figured it out, that they published my article. So
did you write a nonfiction piece or a fiction piece?
Yeah, no, it was a nonfiction piece. It was a kind of one of those. This happened to me.
You got paid for writing something that you really thought was great and didn't even realize it. I love that story.
And so, from then on, I had this wonderful misconception that all I had to do was just sit down and write some stuff and mail it in, and then money would show up. Which took a long time to change my mind on how that works, but
we know a lot, don't we? At 18,
we
got it all covered.
Know about everything. I came to a kind of a crossroads about my future, and so I decided that I knew enough about writing to get published, so I could just leave college behind, and I did, and I went off and chased my flying career with the promise that I would write a novel.
Your flying career is fabulous. Your flying career has been just amazing.
Oh, it's fun.
Tell listeners a little bit about it. You're obviously a flight instructor because you've got like 4 million hours in the air, so you've, you know, flown everything except for the space shuttle, I would imagine. tell everyone what you've done with your flying career, because you've had some interesting stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fun because I didn't realize how much fun I was having at the time. Looking back, it was amazing. But I was always just trying to get to the next level, and that's kind of what. That's what flying is. You start out with no experience, no hours, and you just try to build that. And so I got my ratings. I got a commercial license. I got an instrument rating. I got my flight instructor rating, which then allowed me to get paid to fly. I could flight instruct, which was awesome. And then I got another instructor rating. Then I got a multi-engine rating. And then the most amazing thing happened, and I knew this was big when it showed up, but there was a man that came to Wichita to pick up a jet that a sheik in Saudi Arabia had purchased. And it takes two people to fly jets, and he was looking for kind of a young, disposable co-pilot, which was me. And at 20 years old, I raised my hand, and I'm like, ooh, ooh, pick me. I want to go to Saudi Arabia.
I love this.
So I did, and it was awful. I have to tell you, it was such an experience, but for a Kansas boy, in and up in Saudi Arabia was just such a culture shock. I think it'd be a culture shock to anyone.
But
all of a sudden, in jumping, you know, the levels, all of a sudden I went from a flight instructor into a jet. All of a sudden I'm flying jets. I'm 20 years old. And it's, and that I understand is significant. And so I flew there for a while, not a long time, because it was really awful. But I got to see Europe and a lot of Europe and a lot of the Middle East, which is not very good. But so when I finally came back, I needed to build my total time. I didn't have a lot of flight time as a pilot, though I had some good flight time. Mm-hmm. So I flew cargo, night cargo, in nasty old World War II airplanes, and just built my time up. And then I finally found a corporate job, which is where I always wanted to be. I had when I was in high school, I had a neighbor who was a corporate pilot. He wasn't an airline pilot. He flew a private jet for a corporate. And I would see this guy, and he'd go to work. Pam, it was great. He'd go to work with his golf clubs.
Wow.
And he'd come back like 2 or 3 days later, and he'd have a tan. And I'm like, and in the middle
That's
of that, he got to fly a jet, and then he played golf and got a tan. And I'm like, that's what I want to do. So that's pretty much what I did from 1980 till 2008. It was a great run. I had a great run.
Did you take your golf clubs and get a tan?
All over the world.
How incredible is that?
And I saw a pub or two along the way and some restaurants.
I bet you
and
did.
There was just a lot of things.
I want to know everything about travel, but first I want to know, because I have a lot of questions about it, where was writing while you were flying all over the place? Did you kind of tuck it back in your subconscious, or did you say, maybe I'll scribble off an article every so now and then, or I'm going to write a note because I have an idea for a novel involving a pilot, or how was writing in your life at that time? Or was it even there, other than just logging in the hours?
It was briefly. I know when I was in Saudi Arabia, and it was, again, it's a dreadful place. Climate was, you know, was just deplorable. And we didn't fly, you know, every day. So I lived in a hotel room. And so I was just, there's no television. There's no liquor. There's no girls. I mean, it's really no place for a 20-year-old at all. So I decided that I would just write my first novel. I'd made my promise to myself that I was going to write a novel someday. That was my caveat to quitting college. So I got a spiral notebook and a Bic pen, and I managed to crank out about 40,000 of probably the worst words in succession that have ever been put to paper. It was just awful. And
did
that's
you
when I
know
got it.
That it was awful? Did
oh,
you
yeah.
know at the time
yeah.
it was awful? You did?
Oh yeah. You know, I was excited about the word count, but I didn't, boy, I hated reading it. It was just terrible. And that was, I had my first inkling that it was way harder than that magazine article I wrote. So, and I burned it. I mean, I got rid of it. It's like, there's
You
just,
did not.
I do.
You
this
burned
has to,
it?
I burned it. This has to go away. This is back.
Oh,
I was in Saudi, and I was in the hotel, and they don't have smoke alarms or anything like that, so I burned it in the bathroom and just flushed it. Thank God.
Oh, no. It would have been such a great thing to keep in the bottom drawer of a desk underneath all your Beanie Babies or something, you know?
No, that needed to die.
Oh,
that needed
no.
to burn. So
did
that
you,
sort
did
of
you give
set
up?
Me back. No, well, a little
really?
Bit, you know. And what I did, but I read all the time, too, because I traveled and, I just was always in a hotel room and I always read. And you know, I think I started paying attention to not so much the story, but to how it was constructed. And I think that's kind of was the extent of my, I was kind of teaching myself kind of how it went. How, you know, what did this author do? And how did he do that? How did he trick me? And I think there was kind of that sort of subliminal kind of education going on. Because I did not start writing till I was probably, it was years and years later. I mean, I'd been married, I'd been divorced, I had built this solid career flying, and it was, I have to say, it was I don't know, maybe I was 38, 40 years old before I sat down and seriously decided to write. And then, of course, nothing came. I announced to
really? Them
I was ready, and I sat down, I mean, for days and days and weeks and months, and just this blank sheet of paper was all that I had to show for it. So it was brutal. It was hard.
Wow.
So, So it was later. And, the flying thing had I kind of built that career. It wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't going any further. So it was finally time to, and in the winter I was living in Chicago, and the winter time there was just a lot of, I know, well, you know, you got to go where the work is. And so the winter time was a great time to ride. And it wasn't until, and this was a trick I learned, or I don't know if it's a trick, it's what I do. It's what worked for me. I could start, but I didn't know where to go. And it wasn't until I just turned everything around, and I discovered this big, amazing ending to the story. And once I found that was easy. Now I just work your way backwards and figure out where all this,
really?
This stuff starts. Yeah. Yeah, there's a...
Have you outlined, or do you try to go by the seat of your pants?
No, you know, I have to outline. There's enough, and you've read enough of my books, I'm sure, to know that there's enough technical stuff. I have to do a, before I get too excited, I have to do kind of a proof of concept. And it's, you know, it's like, does this fit? Can these people get from here to there in the time that I think the story needs? And so there's a lot of logistics I have to do, and that sort of, in its own way, evolves into the outline. So I do have that.
I think it's a good thing, especially if you're doing it backwards and starting from an ending and then constructing a story from there. Because most people, I have to tell you, Phil, most authors tell me they start off with what if. And not, you know, this is the big bang boom here. It's really they start from the beginning. But listen, your books are damn fine, so whatever you're doing is working, and, you know, don't mess with success.
I don't know how to do it any differently at this point, because I've done, in fact, I just finished number eight. Number eight was just finished, so it's in position. But so it's always been that way. You know, it's always been, I figure out the ending. It's like, and it's like looking at a mountain in the distance. And it's like, that's where we're headed. Now, how do we get there? And so there's a lot of latitude in how I get there. And sometimes I don't go the way I think I'm going to go. But I always end up on that mountain, which is the ending of the book.
Wow. You talk a lot about staying in hotels and reading. So you and I had an interesting little conversation before the show started, and you mentioned that for the past 6 months you actually don't have an actual home, that you reside in hotels. How did your life come to – I mean, I understand when you're flying all over the place and you're never – home for any length of period of time makes sense, that, you know, you're sofa surfing with friends or you're out of the country and staying in hotels and all. But you kind of are a rambling man, sounds like.
They're hobo, transient. There's a lot of different words I get called, but they
I wasn't going to go there.
And I'll get back to the story in a minute, but my son had the best line ever. Is I ended up in this loft in Dallas, Texas. It was downtown. It was nice. And that I'd rented for just a brief period, and my son came to visit me, and his mother and I are divorced, and he shows up, and there's all these interstate highways that climb into the sky almost in downtown Dallas, and this loft is kind of tucked in there, and he walked in, looked around, looked out the window, and he says, I'm telling Mom that you're living under a bridge. So, and he wasn't wrong. So, it wasn't much before that little tidbit that I was flying for a company in Minneapolis, and I had some health problems. And the pilots have to take physicals every 6 months to maintain our captain status. And so from this ended up I ended up not being able to fly. I retired early. So, and I'd written, my first two novels were written while I was still flying, Category 5 and Code Black. Right. And so, and it was kind of a great, it was a great thing because it was, there was this real symbiotic process that took place. I'd fly, I'd always had airplanes on my mind, and the books deal with aviation, of course, to some extent. And so I would, right. I'd sit in a hotel in Budapest, and I would, and I'd start taking notes, and I'd start researching and brainstorming, and or I'd edit. I didn't write so much on the road, but I would, but I could certainly grab what I'd written and edit it while I was out gallivanting around the planet. So all of a sudden, the flying was gone. There was just a, it was like a Tuesday, and it's just like you're done, and it was just a shock.
Wow.
And I didn't. It was like the worst thing that could happen to me. And I didn't know what to do. And I, you know, I had some surgery, and that took a while to kind of recover from. But I was still done flying. So I didn't know what to do. And I was stuck in Minneapolis. I didn't need to be there. I was divorced. My son was in college. There's no reason to hang out in Minneapolis at that point. And so, like any self-respected former hippie, I think it's time for a road trip. So
of course.
So I did. So I called a moving company. I said, how much would it cost to come and get my stuff and put it in storage, you know, like in nice storage and I might not want it for a year. And they gave me a quote, and I said, come get it. So they did. And I put aside the stuff I thought I might need to write another book or catch a fish on a fly rod, put it in my car, and took off and went to Dallas. And I was thinking maybe a year at the most, road trip, figure out where I wanted to be. There were some places I wanted to go visit and that I'd flown to but hadn't spent enough time there to really make a determination if I wanted to, like, live there. So I just kind of set out. So it's 6 years has turned into – or six, so 1 year has turned into almost 7 years. So I rent houses for months at a time. If I'm writing, I go on book tour and I stay in hotels, and I don't have a home. Just a hobo, a writing hobo.
Is your stuff still in storage, by the way?
Uh-huh.
Or did it go to one of those storage wars?
No, you know? I pay the bill. You know, they took it away in a truck, and they bill me every month, but I have not been to the warehouse. I don't really know. That'll be interesting if it's not.
Yeah, I'd be a little upset if it was. Well, listen, you're paying the bill. One of these days, you think you'd go and just say, let's go ahead and get rid of it, because I don't really need it.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I still miss it. I think about stuff. It's kind of like, you know, I can remember the big stuff, and there are things I liked, and there's a lot of photographs.
Obviously, you're not losing any sleep from not having it.
No, I'm not.
You seem to have everything you need 7 years later.
Well, I know, but they gave me, and they really didn't know what they were doing, but they gave me this insanely low storage rate. So they said, yeah, you can leave it here, and I'll tell you what, we'll never raise your rate, and this is what it is, and it's like really low. And they have it. So it almost, it's cheaper to let it sit than to do anything else with it.
Your home's in a storage unit, Phil. Jeez.
So now the only rule I have is if I buy something new, I have to throw something out because I don't want to fill my car up. Yeah.
There you go.
So I just travel around and write, and it's. And it's been as bad as I thought my life was when I couldn't fly. This is, in some ways, way better. and writing is every bit as gratifying as flying jets.
How about that? How about that? I love that. It's such a great story. Your life is a really great story. On your website, you have 5 books that you list that you say have influenced you as a writer or a person. And you start off with the Hardy Boys. And I like that you started with them because I think everybody, boy and girl, read the Hardy Boys when they were little. And if you like mysteries, you obviously had an upbringing with the Hardy Boys. And probably you moved on. You probably read some Agatha Christie too at some point, because you can't. That's graduating from Hardy Boys. You go immediately to Agatha Christie. Did you happen to read her at all, or were you
reading only
boy books? You were reading boy books.
I read boy books because I went from Hardy Boys, and then I kind of branched out, and I'd read Alistair MacLean. Because I'd seen The Guns of Navarone in the theater as a kid and loved it. It's all the army action stuff. And then I found Wilbur Smith. He changed my world with the sweeping historical fiction and the Courtney family. The opening scene in When the Lion Feeds I've read that 50 times, I bet.
But don't you love books like that that you can go back and read every so often and know you're never going to be disappointed?
Oh, no. And what I like is that was his first book. And for him to sit down and do that, it's like I read a quote by him where he sat down, he graduated from college, and he sat down, and I think he took a summer or something to write, and he said he's been unemployed ever since. And I love that line.
I like it too. You are very influenced also by Clive Cussler, who was a guest of mine and a very fascinating man. I enjoyed talking to him. You know that his main character is named after his son. I'm sure you know that by now. Dirk is, and his son writes with him as well as other writers who write with him.
Right.
But Raise the Titanic was a big one, wasn't it?
Well, that's the one that's sort of like go big or go home. And he showed me that you could go big, because when that book came out, no one knew where the Titanic was. And not only did they find it, but Cussler figured out a way to bring it up. And I loved the scope of that.
Yep.
And I've done some, and that book has allowed me to think big and do some things in my books that don't rival that, but they're like, maybe nobody's done this, but maybe just not yet.
Clive is an interesting person, and so I understand why you like him, because he lives his dream too. You have a lot of flying in your books, and of course he is at heart a sunken ship salvager. That's what he wants to do, and that's what he's based his institute on. So he's a fascinating man and very friendly and very down to earth. So you couldn't have chosen a better one.
Yeah, I'd like to meet him sometime. I just have never crossed paths with him.
He tells me that people go to his house and knock on his door, and he answers and invites them in. And he lets the people that he doesn't know. He's always happy to talk to readers. He said it's the best thing that he does. That's the best thing about his job, is talking to people who read his books. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, and that is. And there are some, there are some real unexpected kind of benefits of becoming a best-selling writer or a published writer, is that all of a sudden you join this sort of elite club, and you're one of them. You're one of the guys that used to be your heroes are now like they're your peers and your drinking buddies, and that's remarkable.
Absolutely. It is remarkable, and I will tell you that, we talked earlier about conferences. Of course, in our network, I'm the only one who's not a writer. I'm the only host. There are 14 shows. We have 4 more in development right now, and all of the other shows are hosted by writers except for me. Of course, their shows sound nice and edited and professional and like NPR. Mine sounds like Funny Farm. That's okay. I'm good with that. But I go to those conferences because I love writers so much, and I get to meet people like you and Clive and you know, D.P. Lyle and all those people, and it's always a ton of fun. I found my tribe anyway. At least they've adopted me, so I'm grateful to you writer folk for that.
Really?
Since people who write are my celebrities. I say that all the time, and I'm very blessed to know all of you. So now you're a gypsy. You're a writing gypsy versus an acting gypsy. You are in Boise, Idaho right now, which it just tickles me for no end, because I didn't think that Boise was a destination city. But obviously, you went there for a reason, and I'm glad. Are you writing now, or have you finished and are you taking a break?
I just finished book number 8. It's book number 7, Seconds to Midnight, that comes out in 3 weeks or a month.
March 7 or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the way my publishing schedule has been is I start writing June 1st. I try to be done from the book tour for the book before, and it's time to land somewhere and sit down and write the next book. And so I don't really know how long that takes. I've written a rough draft in as little as 7 weeks, and the one I just finished took 6 months. So they're like children.
Really?
They're all different. So I kind of, you know, I kind of, and I am a hermit, and that's a little why I don't have a permanent address, is that, you know, I move around and I pick different. I think sense of place is very important in my process. So I typically go to Montana, and I spend the entire summer in Montana with a ritual that involves me getting up in the morning, and I have some tea, and I start writing, and I'll write till, you know, maybe one or so afternoon, and have a late lunch, and then the rest of the day is mine, and I'll go fly fish. And when I'm done fishing, it's usually about happy hour, and then you just repeat as necessary until you have a rough draft.
There you go.
And so, but I don't always make it. Sometimes it starts snowing in Montana, and I need to leave. So from there, I've been going to the Pacific Northwest, and the last 3 years, I've gone to, I love the San Juan Islands, and I've lived there in my little trek here. I've rented houses in several different locations there, just getting a feel for that place because I really like it. And then it's Victoria, British Columbia, that I've spent a lot of time there in the last 2 years because I love that place. And there's a hotel that is right on the Inner Harbor, and I can just walk everywhere. And I think what this does is it simplifies my life to where I can focus on the writing.
That's great. You want to take a call? Let's take a call.
Sure.
And see who's calling
to
chat with you. Okay. Let's see. Area code 858. You're live on the air. Who's this?
This is Matt in San Diego.
Hey, Matt Coyle. How are you, my friend?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. Say hi to Phil Donnelly.
Who? I'm not familiar with him.
Hi, Matt.
We share an agent,
Matt and I
a publisher,
were just chatting
a publicist.
Earlier. Pardon me?
Excuse me. We share an agent, a publicist, and a publisher.
And a web designer. Yeah,
and a talk show.
And
a talk show host. And a talk
exactly.
show host, too. See that?
That's right. It seemed like you started early today. I missed the first few minutes of the show because out here it usually comes on at 6.
Yes.
I want to ask Phil, with the next book coming out just a month from now, where are you going to tour?
I have, it's always kind of the question, isn't it? And with all the places I've lived, and I kind of try to claim a lot of places as being home. So I think where I'm headed right now is I'm headed to the Midwest, and Minneapolis is just it's where I was first published. It's been a great community for me. They're great fans. There's a lot of writers in Minneapolis, and the local people really support them. So I'm starting there and just kind of trying to maybe branch out to Chicago if we can pull that off. There's a place.
It's so really cold there.
Well, yeah. You know, they're used to it. We're used to it. I mean, I lived in Chicago and Minneapolis. So that's going to be the bulk of it, I think, to start. And then as the year goes on, there'll be a stop in Montana. There'll be a stop in the San Juan Islands in Washington. And who knows what pops up. But the bulk of it is going to be the Midwest and places that I've lived.
So here's the question.
Did you know they have bookstores down here in Southern California?
You know, we looked at that, my publicist that we share, and I told him, I said, you know, it'd be great to do a signing with Matt and, you know, get a group of us and just do the hobo thing up the coast to San Francisco. And somehow that was going to be cost prohibitive or something. It didn't work.
But you guys, here's my question for both of you. Your publisher is just up the road from where I live. We have some really great bookstores in Southwest Florida. We really do, some really terrific places. And on Sanibel Island, which is, in my humble opinion, the only place to be in the wintertime, it's absolutely fantastic. This is the best time of the year to be in Florida. Why don't you two ever come east? I don't understand this. I would be very happy to set up book stops for you, signings for you.
Well, for me, it's a cost situation. Although I was going to venture further east, this last book came out in December, but
right.
It came out came out late in the year, and I thought about weather. But
right.
Next year, I'm hopeful of going east actually, and that would be a great opportunity for me.
Yeah, and
if
David's right up the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we could work something out like that, I've got my mother lives in Florida. I could come that way and meet you guys and we could do some
fun
book stops.
And I have friends that pop down here all the time who would, you know, be happy to. I mean, I'll invite Joe Clifford down too because he's with you guys, you know, and have
him
come down
him
and then, pardon me?
I'm not familiar
what?
With him either.
Yeah,
right.
Everybody knows Joe.
Everybody knows Joe.
anyway,
my pal.
I just wanted to say hello. I want to say hello and see if we get filled down to Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego or Warwick's or something, but another time.
You never know. You never know, buddy. I appreciate
yeah.
the call. And, you know, keep writing. You guys, your stuff is so, so wonderful. I, you know, wish you all the best.
Thanks,
Matt's
anybody.
My
I'll
most favorite. Matt's my favorite caller because he's always got really interesting, and he knows everybody. He's got interesting stuff to say, and he knows everybody. We just had a half hour conversation on Facebook today, just before you and I were getting together, Phil. So, Matt, you and I will be talking, right?
You bet. Sounds great.
Matt's gonna do it. He's gonna guest host. He's gonna interview Dave Putnam. On his new book. How about that?
Very good. Very good.
Dave,
it comes out
too,
tomorrow.
Right?
It comes out tomorrow, right? Dave's
yeah.
book?
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
You know Dave,
anyway,
don't you, Phil?
Yeah.
See, I'm telling you, the whole bunch of you should make a tour and just kind of caravan through Southwest Florida because there are so many good books. Even on the East Coast, I know a ton of places where you can go. And some, you know, book clubs too, in some very affluent areas.
Wow. Interesting.
Oh,
but we'll have to shelve that but keep that on the back burner and see what we could do.
Absolutely.
Okay, there you go.
All right.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
Join the show.
We'll talk.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Okay.
Bye.
You bet. Bye.
I want to talk about your writing process. You've told me a little bit about it, that you like to write early, and you write, you know, from the morning till about 1 o'clock or so.
Right, yeah.
After outlining substantially, you do a lot of research, I'm assuming, because even though you know about aircraft and the various kinds, and you've been in a lot of different countries, you still must have some research to do. Or am I wrong? Do you not research at all?
Oh, I do tons of research.
I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, there's different levels of research. There's the stuff that only I can do, and I have to do it. But then there's other stuff, because once you start researching, you know, the writer brain is just, it's like, well, what if? Well, I wonder if, and what if that was, you know,
right.
What if that was a submarine?
You're sucking it all in like a sponge, right?
Yeah, you know, it's like, should that be the DEA or does the Coast Guard do that? And there's all of these questions I have. And so what I do is I met this woman on book tour, and she's a huge thriller reader. And we got to talking, and she promptly, like, read all of my books and then offered herself as a researcher. And
wow.
We had talked on a price. She was a stay-at-home mom, and just, I mean, whip smart. I just can't say enough about her. And so so I give her all this other stuff. And so she, not only can she do research, but she can do it with all of the series in mind, which is, I mean, sometimes the most research I have to do is like what I wrote in book two. That's where I'm at sometimes. I'm like, how old is this person now? Where did he go to school? What color are Donovan's eyes? And I don't remember because I did this years ago. So, but Victoria keeps me on the straight and narrow, and so I send her stuff. Like, Seconds to Midnight is coming out in March, and I know all about this book, and I know where it goes, and all the concept stuff works, but then I want to know, like the climate at all the places. I mean, the book takes place
right.
in the wintertime. How much snow is on the ground? How much snow might there be? What time does the sun set? What time does the sun rise? And there's a lot of those things that are,
mm-hmm.
are parts of the book, mm-hmm. and the accuracy needs to be there. But I don't want to dig that up. So. But I end up with tons.
You
of
could
research.
Research yourself into a hole, though, couldn't you, Phil?
Oh,
if you're not careful.
Lost. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
And maps. I'm just a map junkie. I start.
I love maps too. I understand that. I understand maps and the need to look at maps and then want to look at more and then want to get down to like the street level and then the actual, you know, the city planning and everything. I get that completely. I understand about maps. I'm a huge map fan, which explains how I doesn't explain how I have no sense of direction whatsoever, but I can read a map and get you from one end of the country to the other. If I have a map, I'm good. Otherwise, turn me in a circle and ask me what direction I'm heading. I have no idea.
So well, if you can read a map,
there's a lot of
people that I know that can't, so good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, and thank God for MapQuest, too, and Google Earth. So, you know, Google has made it a lot easier to research. But here's what I want to know. Because you're so well-traveled and because you go different places to write, do you follow in your character's footsteps?
You know, some. Sometimes the story obviously takes it out of the realm of where I've been. But I do know a lot of the ideas have sprung from my travels. So the book Pegasus Down, which came out last year, takes place almost entirely in Eastern Europe. And a great deal of it takes place in Budapest, which is where I used to spend a lot of time. And I'd sit in the Marriott on the Danube, and it's just gorgeous. And all these, I mean, it's so old, the bridges, and it's just the people, and it's just a... And I would sit there and go, you know, there's got to be a way to incorporate this place in a book, and I did. I finally figured out a way to do it. So at least the genesis of the stories take place where I have been,
And then when we get to the some of the, you know, we get to the morgue or we get to the back alleys and stuff like that, you know, I'm not so much. I may have to make
right.
that up.
Well, yeah.
So.
I'm talking just the cities and everything. So we're running out of time, and I want to speak to you for like a whole nother hour. I want to ask you, do you name your books or does your publisher?
This is, I name them, and it's very important. I can't start until I have a title.
Really?
And
really?
Yeah.
Because
no.
A lot of authors tell me they wait till it's at the end, and sometimes it's a thread that they pull out of the book somewhere along the line during edits, and they say, that's what I'm going to call it.
No,
so is
I
this
can't.
Part of your the big ending thing? So you know
yeah.
the big ending, and that's your title? You know, the big ending is the title, or it comes at the same time?
Kind of all sort of happens that way. You know, it's sort of a that's the big bang, if you will, that takes place.
Wow.
So I figure out the ending, and then from there I come up with the title, and because I can't start the book until I know what the name of the book is. So, and that's
funny.
that's a little of my OCD. But so when
that's
so
okay.
I get my
it works for you.
I get my little Word document set up, and I put the header up there, and it's got the title, and it's got my name, and only then can we start.
Well, you know, it's like laying out the plates and flatware on a table before you eat. So I understand that. You know, it makes sense to me. There's something about the order of it all that appeal to my OCD as well. So
yeah.
I get it. When you're writing, are you one of those who can go to a cafe someplace or a coffee shop and hear the cacophony, which becomes ambient background noise, and you'll just happily write away? Or would you prefer to have relative peace and quiet?
I need the peace and quiet. And I need I can have a little background music on, just as sort of white noise, which is
right.
fine. And I just, you know, I have iTunes on my computer, so I just pick a playlist, and then I'm stunned at how many times it repeated itself, and I didn't really notice. But, yeah, I do that. I need the quiet. I have to laugh at myself sometimes. I'll plant myself in Montana next to a window with just an extraordinary view, and I won't look out the window for the whole time I'm writing. I just don't. Later, when it's happy hour, I'm like, look at that view. But I'm pretty
wow.
and I'm pretty focused when I'm writing.
How great is that? When you listen to music, what kind of music do you like to listen to?
When I write, I listen to a lot of just classical. I don't like a lot of lyrics because that just seems to get in the way of what I'm trying to do. So
get in the way of your own lyrics, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I listen to a lot of classical music and just kind of, you know, just soundtracky stuff from movies I like, and just music that it's just there. You know, it keeps me from hearing the refrigerator hum or whatever. And so.
So when you're not writing, what do you listen to?
Oh, it can be a lot of things. It can be anything from lately I've been listening to Pink Floyd. So, and then
you're in retro, aren't you?
Well,
there's
that. You know, I watched something on TV, and there was just something not too long ago about one of the remaining members, and then I got to thinking about that, and all of a sudden I'm listening to that. And I like alternative music. I think when I have to go look,
yeah.
I like, but I like folk music too. You know, but the hippie in me still likes some of the heavier rock.
Oh yeah, I hear that too. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Whose book is on your nightstand right now?
There is not one. One of the big casualties.
Oh my God.
I know.
Horrors.
One of the big casualties of being a writer is I don't get to read like I used to. I won't read fiction while I'm trying to write my own. And then when I'm done writing, which is what I'm doing right now, I'm catching up, I'm traveling, I'm seeing friends, and and I'm just kind of revert to, I'm kind of a magazine person. And so I have my Kindle and I have subscriptions to 35 magazines that keep me going. And so
do
I
you
don't.
Really? What kind of magazines do you like to read?
Oh, there's fly fishing. There's airplane stuff. There's entertainment stuff. There's sciencey stuff. There's a magazine for every little nook and cranny of the human existence out there, and you can usually get it. I was reading Discover, and then there's archaeology magazines, and then there's space magazines, and I love all that stuff.
Well, I hear you. Although I don't own a television, so that's never been an issue for me. So if you could have anyone write a story about your life, who would you want to write it?
It's funny you mentioned that. We were just talking about him online, but one of the best paragraph-for-paragraph writers that I know is William Kent Kruger. And
He was magnificent. Did you listen to the podcast?
I did not. I've been able to sit at the St. Clair Broiler and have a beer with him.
Oh my God, in booth number 4. You know, that was probably one of, I think, a highlight in my life was that interview on the Friday night.
Yeah. It,
what a magnificent man. If ever there was our country had an author laureate, it would be William Kent Kruger. There's no doubt.
And he's such a classic.
What
man.
A magnificent guy. I've turned a couple people on to Ordinary Grace.
And
as a matter of fact, one of the other hosts, she said, I'm going to stay up all night reading this. And I said, welcome to my world. You know, I understand that. When you find someone who is that fine of a writer, you have no problem whatsoever staying up. Good choice, by the way. Good choice. Fun. Let's tell everybody where they can find you on the webs so that people know how to get to you.
Well, there's Facebook. And I'm kind of a Luddite, I think if you Google me, it all shows up. There's my website, philipdonnelly.com. There's Goodreads. There's Amazon. There's Barnes & Noble. There's, I tweet poorly. Some of this is kind of new, and I just never got confident with it. But I check that stuff. So if somebody is, I'm a great responder. If you write to me through my website, I read all that. I respond to all that. And please do. I'd love to hear from readers.
About your newsletter? Do you put out a regular newsletter, or is it just whenever you kind of get a hair up your ass, you want to go ahead and say something?
You know, it's kind of when there's something to say.
Okay.
Kind of like my blogs. I've written several. I don't know, there might even be 50 blogs. And some of them I'm kind of proud of, and they're there, but I don't know that they're, you know, people respond some. I always respond back. They're there. But I'm a little more passive in that regard. I think people get tired of hearing me talk about my next book that's coming out. I try not to be the town crier about that all the time.
Good for you. Philip Donnelly, it has been so much fun talking to you. I'm sorry that it took this long for us to get on the air together, but I do hope that you will come back and maybe you'll do what our mutual friend Matt is doing, and you will take a turn behind the microphone. He is going to be interviewing Dave Putnam, like I said. And you know, Dave is like the gentle giant. I love he and Mary. They're wonderful people.
I would
love for you to come back. You've got a great radio voice, by the way. So why don't you come back and pick out an author you like and interview them?
I'd love to do that. I would love to do that.
Yeah.
We should.
You know.
It's like I feel like you're my new best friend. Just this voice on the radio. This is so much fun. I've had a great time.
Thank you. So have I. So have I. It's been great fun having you on. And I want you to come back again, please.
Okay.
It would be my guest.
Okay.
But we'll keep in touch, since since you don't do social media and I do every social media there is known to man, just simply because I'm sick that way, we'll continue our conversations through Messenger on Facebook. And I'm gonna make you decide on a guest, and then I'm gonna set you up to be the host. How about that?
Okay. Well, now I'm a little scared, but yeah, we'll.
It'll be great. It's gonna be fun. Are you kidding me?
Like before, I got on the phone. I wasn't coming to Florida, and I wasn't gonna be a host of anything. But now I am. So.
Now you're going to be a guest host. It's going to be great.
Okay.
You can interview Matt if you want. I don't care. You know, you'll have a good time. And then I get to sit back and be a tech for the night and listen to the great conversation of wonderful authors. Thank you so much for being my guest, Phil. I truly have enjoyed this hour more than I can tell you. It's been a lot of fun. You have such an interesting life, and I'm thrilled that you spent this much time with me. Thank you so much. Oh,
thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
Thanks. We'll talk again soon. Have a great night.
Bye-bye.
And that's our show for tonight, folks. I'm so glad that you spent the time with me and Phil Donnelly. He's terrific. His new book releases on March 7. In the meantime, tomorrow I'm talking to another really fun man, Simon Wood. You're going to love him. Thanks for being with me. Read a good book, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.